And now we are ready to start tonight's session, and I'm really, really thrilled to introduce our guest, Rona Novick. Rona is the director of the Gottesfeld Heller Doctoral Program at the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at Yeshiva University, and a clinical professor of child psychology at North Shore Long Island Jewish Medical Center. Dr. Novick also serves as a co-educational director of Hidden Sparks, providing consultation to day schools and yeshivos. Dr. Novick developed the Alliance for School Mental Health at North Shore Long Island Jewish Medical Center and served as its director for 8 years, authoring the Brave Bully Prevention Program for schools. Dr. Novick is the author of the Bullying Your Child Make Friends and editor of the book series Kids Don't Come with Instruction Manuals. I'm also really happy to introduce our co-facilitator, Betsy Kane, who will be working with Rona tonight. Welcome, Rona and Betsy. Rona, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Judith, for that lovely introduction. What Judith didn't say is that probably my best qualification for talking about variations in child development is being the mother of three very different children and getting lots of on-the-job training. So what I hope that we'll do together tonight is think about how, as parents, we're constantly watching and wondering and worrying about our children. We see our children never in isolation, but we see them in comparison to the other children around them. And we are frequently scratching our heads and asking, is what our child doing, or is what they're not yet doing, a reason for concern? Or is it just part of the typical variability and variation that we see in children? Today we're going to discuss how child development proceeds along a continuum, that some behavior and learning issues may be outside the pattern of typical development, and they may warrant some assistance, us providing some assistance, or us being more concerned, but others are perfectly normal variabilities. And we're also going to discuss some of the tasks that are most commonly mastered at different ages. So hopefully we'll together develop some understanding of the process of development. We'll learn about the very commonly used notion of the milestone, a developmental milestone. We'll focus on recognizing and building children's growth. And we'll also talk about what to do when we have realistic areas of concern. So the first thing I want you to do is take a trip down memory lane. And I want you to think of a time in your own childhood when either yourself or your parents or your teachers noticed something about you that you did differently, or something you didn't do that everybody else among your peers were doing. Were people asking themselves, is this typical? I hope everyone can think of something in their life. And then I'd like you to think about whether or not it's still an area of concern. My guess is, and I'm going to ask in a moment, raise your hand if you'd like to share yours, but my guess is that for most of you, if there was something that, through your childhood, people wondered or worried about whether you could or could not do it, whether you would or would not do it, that it probably has not remained an area of concern. If anyone would like to share their example, you can raise your hand and I will unmute you, or feel free to share your example in the chat room. Type in what it was that you couldn't do. For me, I see some people are writing it. For me, it was math facts. And in fact, I was an absolute math fact disaster until college, when playing cards and learning to count cards finally turned me into somewhat of a number wizard. So that all the years of my parents' worry, it just took some card games. Now, consider we're going to meet a couple of children, a couple of different children and examples to help us think about some of the issues in development today. So let's talk about David for a moment. When you walk into the den, David is doing some schoolwork. His siblings are spaced around the room, also doing their homework. David looks carefully at the work in front of him, rocking his chair from time to time. And he looks over at his sister, who's working on her paper, and grabs her marker. When she protests loudly and says that she's going to call Mom or Dad to tell on him, David pulls his chair to the corner of the room and huddles under it, facing away from everyone. He begins speaking to himself. I'd like a show of hands. If you think the parent should be concerned, if you think that what David is demonstrating is not typical and it's an area of concern for parents, raise your hand. Use the hand icon to vote that you think this is an area of concern. Okay, we have a few. Oh, we have more votes. We have a number of people voting that it's an area of concern. Now, of course, this is a little bit of a trick question because you're only seeing a piece of the story. So we have to ask ourselves, what more would you want to know? And again, you can use the chat room feature to type in the questions you would have. Certainly, it depends on how he's behaving in his huddling, Yechezkel wrote. And very important, Miriam's question, how old is he? Or is this how he always acts? All of these are really important questions. So that the take-home message here is that before we can answer the question of whether something is typical or not, we need to know more than what we're seeing in that little snapshot in that moment of behavior. If people could clear their hand raising for me so that it will be there the next time we need it. Let's take a minute to look at the realities of development, and then we'll go back to our question of typical or not. One of the first important realities of development is that there are no absolutes. You've probably all heard the term developmental milestones. When do children walk? Well, what I've given you are pictures, snapshots of walking, reading, and the first age that you go to sleepaway camp in a group of randomly selected children. And this is a very typical snapshot. If you check when children walk, it will be anywhere from, it could be 9 months, it could be 14 months of age, but all of these children, Michael, Shira, Adina, Yossi, they're all typical children, even though no two of them walk at exactly the same point. The same is true with reading, where we have Yael reading in the eighth month of nursery, and Dara not until the ninth month of first grade. But all of these fall within typical development. So there is a milestone for reading, and most children reach that milestone somewhere in the kindergarten first grade window, but it's a pretty big window. And the same is true with sleepaway camp. But here we have an interesting child because take a look at Ben. Ben never went to sleepaway. So that there are some developmental tasks or milestones that not every child will complete successfully because they're not a requirement, whereas every child has to become a reader, not every child has to go to sleepaway camp. Sometimes when we're worrying or wondering about a child's difficulty in development, it may be because the outside world or parents or school are hoping or pushing a child to develop before or even if they don't ever need to be ready to do that. I'm going to ask you to vote for this slide. I have represented here, A, B, and C, three different possible pictures of a child's development. If you think A is the best picture representation, the best graph of the process, how a child goes through development, then raise your hand. If you think B is the best, then use the check mark right next to the hand raising icon and vote with a check mark. And if you think C is the best option, then vote with the X. So vote now, A, hand raising, B, check mark, C, and X, on which you think is the best representation of the process of development. So we have some people voting for B. Nobody, you're all way too smart. Oh, wait, yeah, I know, somebody just unraised their hand. You're all way too smart, and you all know that A is just not realistic. Development doesn't proceed in a totally upward, even fashion. we know that development has bumps in the road. Some of you opted for B as your option, but the correct answer is actually C. And the reason being is that very often before development moves forward, children take a little step backwards. If you think about infants, very often when an infant has a really cranky period and then they cut their new tooth, everybody in hindsight says, wow, now I understand why he or she was so cranky. It's because a new tooth was coming in. Or right before a child starts crawling, ah, now I understand why they were so miserable. They were about to master a new task. That's actually true for all areas of development. Very often, there's a little bit backwards in order to move forward. So the developmental progress process is irregular. It's unique to every individual. We have different development charts that are as unique as our fingerprints. The same phenomena, for that reason, is going to look very different across different ages. So a phenomena, for example, of aggression. If we take a big idea, and if we say as a parent, I'm worried about my child who is aggressive, or I'm worried about my child who is anxious, or I'm worried about my child who is unmotivated. By the way, all of those words, aggressive, anxious, unmotivated, are very vague and nonspecific. But as a large idea, let's take one of them, aggression, and let's look at how different it looks across developmental ages. For infants and toddlers, physical aggression, when they're frustrated, is very common, and it almost knows no bounds. An upset toddler will bite or kick or hit or pull hair or throw things, and most of us would not think that that's highly unusual if we saw it in a toddler. Of course, if we see that in a high school student, we know that that's quite unusual. As the child grows, they begin to understand that physical aggression is not permitted in certain contexts, and certain types of physical aggression start to drop out. It's pretty rare that we see biting in school-age children, and even rarer above second grade. We also see a change in aggression because of new skills that come into a child's repertoire. So in the middle of elementary school, we have verbal and social skills that become greatly developed. And so while there may be a great deal of arguing, some physical fighting even with siblings and peers, most of the aggression is going to be verbal. And as children develop through pre-adolescence, preteen, and their teen years, physical fights become much rarer. There are outlets for aggression like sports and other high levels of verbal aggression, like sarcasm and teasing, come into play. So it's going to look different as our children age. We can't talk about development without talking about the critical role of temperament. Temperament, these are born with their own combination of physical characteristics. Behavioral scientists know that children are also born with the patterns of behavior or temperament that make them the unique individuals that they are. I've given you here the most common arrangement of temperamental factors: activity level, regularity, a child's initial reaction or their ability to tolerate novelty, distractibility, how adaptable they are, how intense they are, mood, persistence, and sensitivity. We could write volumes on each one of these, but any one of you who has more than one child knows that very early on you have a sense of which children are extraordinarily regular, easily adaptable, moody, or overly sensitive. These factors are fairly obvious pretty early on. But these factors also exist on a continuum. So let's just take an example of three factors. In terms of activity level, we might have on, I have on the left side of this slide, a baby, an infant, or a child who's extremely low in activity level to the point of being sedentary. This might be a child who is, their default setting, their most comfortable and easy way of being is sitting still. And on the other hand, a child whose activity level is absolutely nonstop, off the charts. I will never forget when my first child was born, my sister-in-law was the only one in my family who had children, and she had two little girls who were on the sedentary end of the spectrum. And I gave birth to a child who was on the nonstop end of the spectrum. And she would give me sage sister-in-law-ly advice that, well, maybe I should, you know, give him a book when he's in the car seat. And my child would, you know, use the book as a ramp to wedge himself out of the car seat and hop over four seats and undo some seat belts. So the difference in children's activity level, it can be very, very striking. And often what works or what helps or is appropriate for a child on the sedentary end of the spectrum will not apply to a child who is a nonstop actor. Intensity. I've given you again the two poles from a very, very calm and hard to upset or rile child to a high-strung, extremely high-strung and prickly child. And adaptability from a child who loves and needs sameness and routine and even small changes are very off-putting to a child who enjoys novelty. I would like you to use the chat room now to share any temperamental factor. I'll go back for a moment so you can see them in front of you. Any one of these temperamental factors, feel free to share any one of them that has been particularly challenging for you with your child. Needless to say, one of the great challenges we have as parents is sometimes having a child whose temperamental setting does not match our own. If we are a risk taker, we love high intensity experiences, and we have a very quiet, calm, timid child, that's not a great match for either parent or child. Someone thinks the same temperament is the hardest. Miriam, I'm not sure about that. You may need to clarify. I'm not sure I'm following what you mean by that. So maybe you can clarify for me. Why does temperament matter? Let's look at Shira and Sarah. Shira was a very easy baby, as people call them, who had a regular schedule for eating and sleeping. She took to everyone really quickly, loved new things. When she was given something hard to do, if she had to reach hard to get to a rattle or learning to walk, she pushed herself. But she was often calm and was very easy to soothe and seemed happy most of the time. And then there's Sarah. Sarah's parents remember how she was colicky and never slept. She was finicky about who she would let near her, and they went through a series of babysitters. She feared all things new. She was tentative in most situations, would quickly reject new things if she would try them. And she was very often upset, fussy, and hard to soothe. She had intense reactions of distress quite often. What do you think each girl's parents saw at their daughter's seventh birthday party at a noisy and engaging bowling alley? And again, feel free to use the chat room. And then ask yourself the question also, which child would you have an easier time parenting? Which child would have an easier time in first grade? Temperament does matter. It does make a difference. Shira would have lots of friends and would be very well liked, as Karen had added in the chat room. Temperament does make a difference socially. It certainly can have a huge impact. Now, here's the thing,
Rona,
that's important.
Yes,
Mona,
go ahead. Wanted to point out that there were a couple of other comments in the chat room. People were responding to your question, and in addition, Miriam also clarified her the sameness of temperament, the difficulty.
Thank you.
In
it's hard for me to scroll through all of them.
Right, there
you.
Are
that's
there
really
people
helpful.
Have really
we have all,
people are really are, participating very
it's
well.
Terrific. So I agree with you, Miriam, that when there are certain temperaments when the parent and child have the same, that you're absolutely right. An intense child and an intense parent is a very hard match, as well as when you have a very calm child and a very intense parent can also be frustrating for everyone. So those are really good points. I also love Yecheskel's point that if you knew that Sarah was your daughter, you probably shouldn't make the party at the alley. She's lucky to have you for a dad, Yecheskel. That's a really good catch. The other input from Karen about, do a party, but do it with a few friends or just family and not make it overwhelming. So these are all a very good segue into the fact that it's really important to remember about temperament, that what is typical, what's most comfortable, what's, again, your default setting for each person relates to your temperament. And extremes of temperament often seem odd to others, but they feel very natural to the person who's experiencing it. Now, temperament is malleable or avoidable. I'm not someone who sits still easily, but I can calm myself. I can enjoy a restful day at the beach. It just takes me more effort than it takes other people. And I think one of the important things we have to think of as a parent is when we are asking our children to go outside their temperamental comfort zone, that does require effort and energy on their part and perhaps some additional support for us. Just like Karen said, we can bring Sarah to the bowling alley, but maybe only with a few friends or just family. When you think of children who've been challenging, what temperamental factors have been the most difficult for you? What temperamental factors were the issue? Some of you had already included in the chat room regarding temperament that sensitivity and intensity have been particular issues. There are some temperamental factors that are more likely to kind of interfere with family life and cause distress, and there are other ones that are a little bit more personal and private, and they don't seem to bother you as much. But I thank you, Helene and Batsheva. Social anxiety and intensity are ones that they've suggested as problematic or as being an issue. And those are two that are going to have direct impact on other people. So let's move for a moment now. Jennifer, thank you. When struggles are difficulties in your children, it can be really challenging. That's absolutely true. And I love Miriam's point also that we very often think of quiet and a quiet child as what a bracha, what a blessing. But a child who is quiet in the classroom can be a huge stress and strain. And parents can wish and want for them to open up and get a little bit past some of that shyness and temperamental reserve. And Raquel also, distractibility is another issue that although it may seem that it's unique or specific to the child and very personal, it has a large impact on families and certainly in school as well. So given that there's a range in development and given that these temperamental factors come pre-wired, should we worry? As parents, should we be concerned about some of the things that we're seeing with our children and what should concern us? So let's go back to David for a minute. Remember, David had grabbed his sister's marker and he was huddled off in the corner. His sister had threatened to call a parent, and David's dad hears the tumult, and he comes into the room and encourages David to go back to do his homework. He asks David about his science book, and David jumps around his dad, giggles, and flaps his arms while he's describing the gravity experiment that they did in school. When Dad asks questions, David interrupts virtually every sentence with facts about the solar system, and the universe. So I ask you again, show of hands. Vote. If you think this is typical, raise your hand. And people are already, I see, writing into the chat room, what would you need to know to answer the question? So I don't see many hands going up, which means that the vast majority of us are beginning to be concerned. We don't think this is typical, so now I'm going to ask, show of hands, are you concerned about David? Raise your hand if you're starting to get worried. If David's your child, I see some worry. I see some hands going up. Not typical of child who's a homework age. Okay, so you're already using some of the information, that's great, as a kind of a hint, which is what we do all the time as parents. We say, given that he's doing homework, shouldn't he be past this? Shouldn't he be able to do that? Okay. Now let's consider some other children, just to give you some other examples of how complex it is to ask the simple question of, is this typical? Miriam cries when she doesn't get her way. She crumples up her work saying, I'm stupid, or this is terrible. She asks many clarifying questions about requests or directions and is very close to her sister Sarah, is rarely seen without her. Or Jonathan. He gets very angry when you ask him to stop doing things he likes or when you ask him to begin doing things that are hard for him. He has a lot of arguments at home and at recess. At least once each week, he is called out of recess because he's been physically aggressive. Now, I would imagine you're going to have exactly the same kinds of questions about Miriam and Jonathan that you had about David. Jennifer's great question. It depends on how often this happens. Almost anyone can have a blip, a totally unusual day, and once in a blue moon have a physical aggressive attack. We see here Jonathan's doing this once a week. That's already beginning to answer Jennifer's question, that this happens often. But we don't know age, and we don't know many other things about these children. So in addition to age and temperament that we've also already talked about to some extent, there's one other contributing factor that we have to ask ourselves about whether it's typical, and that's what I'm going to call the local norms. And I always feel a little bit unusual when I say that because, of course, and Miriam's asking a good question, the local norms of home, of school, what do I mean? Kind of what I mean is that what children do in rural Caribbean countries in their free time is very different than what children do in, New York suburbs. So that, you know, if you hear that the child perennially climbs trees, again, in the rural Caribbean, that's not so unusual. But in New York, that would be pretty odd. So you have to know what is typical. The same is true when you think about, for example, children doing, or rural Connecticut. Thanks, Miriam. When you think about sleepovers, I used to get questions from parents in my community of 4- and 5-year-olds because they were concerned that their child wouldn't go to a sleepover party. Now, I said I thought it was kind of crazy. Who does a sleepover party with 4- and 5-year-olds? Of course a 4- and 5-year-old wouldn't go. But in some neighborhoods, this was being done. And so there was kind of an expectation that children would be able to do that. Kira's raised a really good question. The conflicting messages that television gives us about what is typical. Just think about the simple issue, and it's not doesn't have to do with development, it's of dress, that if you were to watch TV, you would think that a certain type of dress is typical, when in our communities it simply is not, and that is true, Miriam, of screen time in general, computers, internet access, et cetera, gives you access to local norms, to different norms that may not necessarily be so local. But there, too, at what age is it typical for a child to have a cell phone? Well, that depends on where you live. At what age do children walk unattended to school? Doesn't that depend on the local norms, on where you live? Of course, part of what goes into whether it's typical is your child. Some of whether it's what age a child walks to school has to do with the child and their readiness, but some of it does have to do with other environment or neighborhood factors. Other important considerations in helping you as a parent think about is what I'm seeing in my child typical or not. We have to think of the tasks of what we're expecting children to do. And again, that doesn't always come from understanding who our child is. Sometimes it's coming from external. It's that in this school, all third graders memorize the following. Or in this neighborhood, all boys play Little League. Well, unfortunately, it may be difficult or a struggle for your child to play Little League. Maybe their motor skills are not the same as those of their peers. So it may not be so much that your child's atypical, but that in this context, given the tasks, the child is experiencing challenges. We also have to ask ourselves, what normative transitions have just occurred? What changes has the child just had to adapt to and adjust to? Now, the typical normative transitions are school-based, going from a preschool setting to, you know, K through six or K through eight, changing again to middle school, changing again to high school. But other normative transitions include things like a new baby coming into the family or a family move, a grandparent joining the family, other moving into the home, other kinds of normative transitions that we may think they may not be on our radar because we think, well, this is normal. All children get new siblings. All children have to go from kindergarten into first grade. Yes, but these do sometimes cause developmental blips, and what we're seeing is in some ways typical given those developmental challenges. And finally, we want to look at the broader ecological risks. What stressors and what supports are available in a child's life? And that may sometimes help us also answer whether something is typical and whether we need to be concerned. Now, let's look at the areas where, as parents, we're almost always considering. We're looking at our children academically, socially, in terms of their kind of overall affect or mood, and their behavior. And let's look at each one of them in terms of what are some of the indicators or red flags that might raise our concern, and what are some of the things that we as parents can do. In academics, of course, it's natural for us to think in terms of skills, to say, well, is my child reading at the typical level of other children their age? Does my child know their Hebrew at the same level? But what I'd like to suggest is that we look in a way more deeper at general skills. And we think, does my child have all the skills that they need to succeed in study patterns, in organization, in how to approach tasks? Do they have a good attitude towards learning? Because sometimes when we are concerned in a content area that skills are lagging, we may be able to help by finding strengths and offering support in some of those other areas. Another way that we can think about our child and ask ourselves, is it typical, is we can look at the learning curve or the learning process. So we may say, well, my child is not at the level that I think is typical, but wow, look how much they've grown in the past 1 month, 2 months, 6 months. And so I see that the learning is beginning to take off. And that can be very important and also very reassuring. Obviously, if the opposite is true, if the learning is flat, if we're not seeing growth in learning, then we may say, well, let's think about how we can support our child in this area. And finally, we want to look more at not just the challenges, but we also want to look at the pattern of strengths, because it's so important to be able to leverage a child's strengths to help them through those things that are giving them developmental difficulty. I'll give you an example of using a strength to help with a challenge. One of my children had great difficulty with writing, not with the physical mechanics of writing, but writing sentence structure, writing things in a nice way. He happened to be an incredible Lego builder. And it was only when we used his Lego building ability to understand writing that he could crack the code. We literally talked about, you know, the blue Legos are the verbs and the yellow Legos are the nouns, and I don't remember all the colors, and the red Legos are the articles, and we would put Legos together to make sentences. It was only by using that strength of his that we were able to get past that challenge. In the social area, the strengths that we look for in our developing children include their ability to make and maintain friendships, their basic social skills, like can they have a conversation, can they give a compliment, accept a compliment, take turns, etc., and very, very importantly, their social problem-solving skills. Can they negotiate and navigate conflict in social situations? Now, of course, how well a child can do this and what we're expecting of them depends on their age. The way a four-year-old negotiates social conflict is very different than the way a 14-year-old does. In addition to the kind of lack of strengths or, you know, feeling that our child might need some support or be weak in an area or not be showing things that are typical in the strengths area, specific concerns may be things like being withdrawn, socially withdrawn, pulling back from friends, physical aggression. As we looked at earlier, most physical aggression drops out in the school years, and it's not very common. So a child who is still using aggression in social situations sends a red flag to us that we need to provide some additional support. A child who has very specific and unusual likes or affinities. Now, every child may have their unusual or quirky hobby. That's fine, but it's a matter of balance. I kind of think about it like having a varied diet. If a parent says to me that their child eats only, you know, two proteins, two types of fruits and vegetables, a couple of starches, and peanut butter, I'm not worried. But if a parent comes to me and says, the only thing my child will eat is peanut butter, then I think part of a parent's job is to improve the diet, to get more variety there. So a parent who says, my child is really interested, like David was, in the universe and in science, that's great, but will he also read books on other subjects? Will he also engage in conversation about other things? Will he play board games? Will he do other things as well? And the final area of social concern has to do with separation. All young children have to master separation from their parents. They usually manage this around the preschool years, and by the school years do okay. But it has its ups and downs, and things like sleepovers and slumber parties and sleepaway camp, and go years and years forward, the year in Israel or going away to college, can cause issues and struggles with separation to return, as well as illness in the family, moves, changes, can cause children to struggle with it. So there are times when struggles with separation are totally normal and typical, and there are other times when they are a signal that a child could use some additional support. In the area of affect and mood, we are concerned as parents, partly because it makes our life harder when we see a lot of moodiness in a child. Feel free again to use the chat room if you'd like to give an example of moodiness in a child, how you saw it, how you knew it was happening. And what I've written here is consider the justification for it, particularly biology. And actually, I'd particularly like you to use the chat room for this. Think about biological factors that contribute to your mood. Can you think of a time that your mood is impacted because of a biological reason. Hungry, tired, pregnant. Thanks, Kira. Absolutely. Pregnancy is kind of like I wouldn't say a double whammy. I think it's like a quadruple whammy because your hormones and you're tired and you're always hungry. Allergies, Karen, that's a great one. But sometimes we see a moody child and we don't realize that they have the same biological realities that we do. And so their moodiness may be totally justified and typical because they were up late the night before or because they're coming down with or they're having horrible allergies, as Karen said, seasonally, or because they didn't eat in the past 12 hours or 6 hours or whatever. So think about the justification, and my number one question is always biology. I know of at least one family, and Karen, I'm so glad you raised it, where Claritin, which is an allergy medicine, totally changed what they thought was a child's temperamental moodiness. And they said, we don't understand. Every fall he just goes bonkers. He's so moody. He's so irritable. He's so difficult. Claritin was the treatment of choice. It was allergies. And it was a young child who couldn't quite say, I'm so moody and irritable because everything itches me and my head feels stuffy. So the child couldn't express it. What the parents saw was just moodiness, but it was a biological issue. Depression. Think also about, is there justification here? Sometimes children are depressed because things aren't going their way, because they didn't get the part in the school play, because their team lost. So there may be reasons that they're looking sad, but be wary and question if the sadness seems persistent and if it's not going away. For most children, sadness that comes for a reason goes away relatively quickly. The other thing to consider is that certainly for preteens and teens, depression may often look more like irritability than sadness. When grown-ups get depressed, we get morose and sad and we feel hopeless. When teens get depressed, they get angry and irritable and prickly. So they may seem like, the typical explosive, irritable teenager, and that may be a sign that really there's some depression going on. And the last one, anxiety and avoidance. Again, of course, look for justification. A child who is afraid of dogs a few weeks after someone in the neighborhood was attacked by a dog, that's a fairly justified anxiety. A child who is afraid of going on a school bus after their bus driver got lost and they had a horrific ride on the school bus that lasted an hour, that seems justified. But look for shutting down or for avoidance. A child who says, I'm never going to ride a school bus again, those are not the typical, they may be kind of a knee-jerk reaction, but it's not a typical lasting reaction. And usually, anxiety that's fleeting, you can reason with a child and say, well, what would help you? Well, how about if you go on the bus and I'll ride, next to you, or I'll pick you up at school and check on the bus, or I'm going to make sure they have a cell phone on the bus so the driver can call if he or she gets lost, they can pull over. Finally, in the area of behavior, the behaviors that most often cause parents concern and questions about, is this typical? We've already talked extensively about aggression, but another area has to do with rituals. Now, I have to say here that all children have rituals at a very young age. It's very, very common. They have just the way that they like to be tucked in, and they have the three stuffed animals that they like on their bed. And even in school age years, there are lots of superstitious rituals. I need my lucky pencil for the test. Or I like the things to be in my backpack this way. One of the ways to help know whether rituals are a reason for concern is if a child voices high degrees of anxiety or worry about a ritual not being carried out, that something terrible will happen. No, I need my stuffed animals this way, or something terrible. The house will collapse. Unreasonable connections and superstitious ideas. Tantrums. tantrums are, again, very typical at young age. They become less likely. But I can actually think of grown-ups that have had tantrums in my building in the past month. So as much as we'd love to say they, go away as children age, they just become much less common. And I think it's an area where frequency, as many of the people were talking about in the chat room, how often it happens is an important indicator of whether it's typical or not. Jennifer's asking a question, how much justification makes behaviors allowable? Yes, you're tired, but you can't not do your homework because you're having a depressive meltdown. By justification, by the way, I don't mean that it's the behavior's allowed. I just mean that it's understandable, that therefore it isn't what I would call atypical. A behavior, by the way, can be typical and still not be allowed. It's typical for preschoolers to bite, but I don't know about you. I'm not allowing my preschoolers to bite someone, and if they do, I'm going to say a loud no. It's typical for young children to reach out for a hot stove or to run into the street not realizing that it's dangerous, but that doesn't mean it's okay. So by justification, I just meant there's a reason for it that you as a parent can say, I understand why this behavior is happening, and so I don't need to have a high level of concern that this is something totally atypical. Do I have to deal with it? Absolutely. As parents, we deal with all behavior, typical or not, and I'll talk about our attitude towards changing behavior and supporting behavior growth in a moment. The last thing I want to mention is low motivation or low responsiveness. Children who seem not to care or hard to engage aren't working towards, you know, what we think is their potential or what they could be doing. And again, we have to ask ourselves in terms of whether this is typical or not, how much of this is this child's temperament, how much of it is the circumstances of this behavior. And Chai has asked a great question about intensity. You're absolutely right. It's not just how frequent something is, but also how intense it is that could make an expected behavior atypical. So I'm going to take the absurd one of biting. Again, preschoolers bite. But if a preschooler is, you know, gnawing away at someone's finger, that's unusual. Even that is atypical because that's not the way that it's usually done. It's not that intense. Young children have tantrums, but a tantrum that goes on for 7 hours is pretty atypical for all age children. So you're absolutely right, Chaya. That's a really great point. Intensity has to be considered also. So the occupational hazards that all of us have as parents is the hazard of comparison. Beware of looking at what other children can do. You want to use your knowledge of what's typical for ages to judge, but try very hard to stay away from worry or panic or that really competitive edge of, oh my gosh, somebody down the block toilet trained their child, now I have to do it. You know, some things you can't push, and you have to allow your child's development to unfold in the way that makes sense for them. Remember, in terms of your anxiety as a parent, which, you know, turning off a parent's anxiety is, I don't know, it's like, I don't think the Hoover Dam could hold back my anxiety as a parent. When it happens, it happens. But remember that concern can lead you to action, but panic paralyzes. So you have to try to keep yourself, in terms of, you know, highest point of intensity, we have to keep our parental response out of the high intensity range. And also, think about your own temperament and think about the fact that it's much more easy for you to be empathic and to really resonate with a child who is like you in some ways and at times very challenging for you to see the world through the eyes of a child who's temperamentally very difficult. If things are atypical, if you say, you know what, after all this, I am really, really convinced that my child's development is not progressing in a typical way. Remember that you as a parent are in the best position to offer loving problem solving, unbelievable amounts of support, and unconditional love and acceptance to your child. You may opt to consult professionals to get guidance and to get support and to get help, but no one can give your child the love and the unconditional support that you're going to be able to give.
Rona, you have there's a comment in the chat box. No, there are two comments in the chat box.
Mm-hmm, thank you. So I'm looking at
Karen.
Remembering that siblings have different temperaments, that's a really good point. I talked about the challenge of being empathic when a parent doesn't match, but it's also a real challenge in a family when you have siblings who are very, very different. And think about, you know, going on a family outing, whose temperament do you best match? You know, who do you accommodate for? And I agree with Jennifer that sometimes you can be empathic, but you also can feel less likely or less able to help someone who is struggling in the same ways that you struggle. I think, have I answered their questions? Helping them recognize it. Yes, it's so helpful to allow children to understand their own being, to understand who they are, and that it's okay to be different, and that some people in our family find X easy and others find Y easy, but that we can all learn how to get along. We can learn how to deal with things. So to sum up and to take all your really wonderful questions, remember that no one factor determines typicality, that it's a complex question, and so it's really important to try to understand the whole child. When concerns emerge, try providing support and encouragement. Exude calm, because worry is contagious and rarely makes children feel better. And this is my most important point. Be hopeful. It's what I call the developmental approach. I think it is just a gift we give children to help them realize that they are growing and changing every day. One of my favorite things to do with children is to have them stand next to me or to stand next to the wall and to mark how tall they are and to say, you know, the next time you come, you're going to be taller. Or to have them make a muscle and say, you know, that muscle wasn't so strong last time I saw you. You are growing and changing every day, and that means if you can't ride the bike today with two-wheelers, tomorrow might be the day. If today you can't spell your name right, you know, you got the letters mixed up, you never know. Your body is growing. Your brain is getting smarter. You are changing every day. Tomorrow could be the day that you do this. That's what I call the developmental approach, that if we help our children see that there's always the potential for more. And the other piece of that is, and I'm going to be right here with you. And we're going to learn together what will help you do this, how we can support you. Kira's question, what about the child's own impatience? I think that, you know, one of the, that's a temperamental factor also, that some children are just so calm and patient and others want it yesterday. But I think that even with the developmental approach and saying, what are some of the things you can do now that you couldn't do a month ago or 2 months ago or a year ago, depending on the age? And remember how terrible it felt when you couldn't, you know, hold the five cards when we were playing Uno, and now you can? I know that's how it feels now, but remember, look, you got there. Now you're holding the Uno cards. I think we have to remind them of their accomplishments and that those moments of impatience are normal. They happen. They happen to us, but that we get past them and they get past them. I think also as children learn to identify their struggles, and if you can say, you know, that's your impatience, what worked for you last time? How did you get past being impatient? I'm looking at Yechezkel's question. There is the issue that at times it may backfire as they end up not being able to ride the bike. They won't be able to accomplish. It's a really good point, Yechezkel. I only use the developmental approach in areas that I'm pretty sure a child is going to succeed. So, of course, if this is a child with a severe delay, a serious limit I do not, I'm the last person who's going to say, oh, tell every child they're going to be the next president of the United States or they're winning American Idol. I don't believe in giving false hope or false promises. But more often than not, I find many of children's frustrations are over small things that they almost probably will get to have some measure of success if they can take a step back and accept some support and, you know, tolerate the ups and downs of the learning curve. Realize that, remember back, and I'll close here and then take any final comments and questions. Remember back to that development graph and that all of you so appropriately knew not to vote for graph A. You all know that development doesn't proceed in a straight line. But I don't think our children know that. They look at everybody else. They look at the child who is riding the bike. They look at the girl who can draw the beautiful pictures or the one who sings the best. And they're asking themselves, why can't I do that? And one of our jobs as parents is to let them know that they're wondrous beings, whoever they are, that in some ways, I hate the topic of this talk, is it typical? Because thank God no child is typical. Each one is their own universe of wonder. And they're all a blessing, and it's our job to help them feel that and see that. Thank you all so much for joining me this evening. Any comments or questions, feel free to type them in the chat room.
Rona,
yes,
I'm going to do all my thank yous in a little bit, but there is actually a question in the chat room that is skipped up a little bit. It's from Rachel. I'll read it for you in case you can't find it.
Thank you.
What about behaviors that seem weird, like a child laughing when someone else is crying or hurt? What do we do with that?
So, you know, I'm going to go back to my own points, Rachel, that to some extent it depends on how often, it depends on how old the child is and what the context is. It sounds to me like that any behavior that I see a child exhibit may indicate to me, it might be a cue or a clue of a skill that's missing. Maybe this is a child who doesn't know that that's not the right way to react and needs help reacting. Maybe it's coming from discomfort. I need to know, you know, in with any behavior, you need to know a lot more to understand why is this happening. But many behaviors, almost all behaviors, we can help our children change and grow past if we can, you know, gain their cooperation and help them to understand that this might not be so helpful. I saw a family just last week where the mom told me that the little girl was telling the teacher all day long in school, I want to go home. I want to go home. A first grader, I want to go home. And the mom explained to the little girl, and it was very effective. She explained to her daughter that, you know, if you had a friend here for a play date and that friend was saying all the time, I want to go home, I want to go home, then don't you think you would feel like she doesn't like you? So maybe when you're saying that all day long to your teacher, it's kind of insulting. The teacher thinks that she's not a good teacher. And it totally changed the girl's behavior. She doesn't say it to the teacher anymore. Quite frankly, she still wants to go home, but she doesn't say it. So the mom's, you know, giving her an explanation really helped. I'm looking at Miriam's question. What about when even the medical community sees the child as typical or within the norms and they're not? What's the best way to persevere? I would like others to have the opportunity to push toward early intervention. It's a challenge, Miriam. There are pediatricians and child psychologists and educators and specialists that are very, very comfortable with a wait-and-see attitude, and a parent will either have a gut feeling or just see a different view of a child and really have a concern that others are not agreeing that it's a concern. And in some cases, again, I can't answer the specifics in a forum like this, but in some cases, a parent has to find like-minded individuals who will be of help. And also, sometimes you have to agree to disagree and work on what you see without worrying about the label typical or atypical. So that, you know, I don't know whether, you know, Johnny's learning or reading is typical or atypical, but if I can find a specialist or someone who's really skilled at working with children on becoming fluent and fluid and exciting and engaged readers, then we can agree that that person's going to work with Johnny. So I may find someone who can work on the issue, even if we don't agree whether something's typical or not. Kira's question, typical or no, what do you recommend if your child is being teased for being in a different place developmentally? Oh, Kira, it's such a hard question because, as you heard in the intro, bullying is an area I work on, and if I had my way, nobody would be teased for anything. But it's just such the nature of the beast, and it happens everywhere and all the time. So I think one of the things we give our children is armor, and we help them understand that it's a horrible thing, but there are people in the world who say mean things, and they say it for all. They say it because they don't like the color of your shirt, or because you talk different, or because you're taller or shorter, and that's a terrible thing. And that, just know that, you know, your child, let them know that there's nothing you did wrong. That when people tease, it's something they did wrong. And other than that, you know, sometimes you can work with schools and the places where it's happening to help to stem it a bit. And Yecheskel's question, Yecheskel saying that having three children recommended for some form of early intervention, and your wife's intuition was the heads on that there was only one who qualified for any at all. Again, I think that I don't want to say parents know best. I'm both. I'm a parent and a professional, and I'd like to say that I'm right 100% of the time, but I'm way too old to know, to believe that. There are too many times that I've been wrong. Sometimes, thankfully, so. And sometimes you just have to ask, what's the cost? You know, if there's no cost in having a consultation or in providing some extra support, then do it. And if the cost of not providing that might be great, then it makes sense to go forward. These are probably some of the hardest decisions that parents have to make, and I'm glad that in your case, Yecheskel, sound like it worked out well. And Chedva, understanding that all children are different, how do you encourage your child who sees themselves as weaker in areas when they are still typical but not the best at any one thing? I guess I would say that I think that sometimes we have to broaden our view. I think that the array of where we look at strengths and weakness is not, it's just not broad enough. That we don't acknowledge people who have extraordinary hearts or are very sensitive. We don't acknowledge people who are really logical. Like, those aren't the things that are usually recognized. So when you say your child isn't the best at any one thing, he might be the best at something, but it's not something that's readily recognized in families, at schools, et cetera. And I think we really have to sometimes, you know, be archaeologists and dig for those things in our children that are extraordinary. Whether it's that, you know, you're extraordinary. I have one child who's just an unbelievable planner who could run people's lives. He's so good at planning things. That's not something that anybody would know about him. You know, unless you haven't planned something for you, you wouldn't know it. But you just have to look for those things. One parent told me years ago about a child, adolescent, who was very difficult. She's having enormous trouble. But she said, but, you know, when he plays the drums, his eyes sparkle. I hate the drums. I hate what he plays. I hate the music. But his eyes sparkle. Well, that's what he's the best at. Is having sparkling eyes. It sounds silly, but it's finding those things that help your child know that he's remarkable and special, and that you see that in him. And the other thing is that we place overemphasis on being the best in something. Sometimes it's absolutely fine to not be the best. Just be you, and that's okay.
There are a couple more comments in the chat room, but right now, Rona, I'm just going to interrupt to share
Please
some
do.
Appreciations with you,
mm-hmm.
and people can keep posting as I'm speaking, and we will kind of scroll through it. But Rona, as you are winding up your prepared comments, people already started posting thank yous and really appreciating all the wonderful information you gave. You took a huge topic with so much information, and you really honed in and gave us some really, really practical ideas and usable information. So thank you for doing such hard work to help us learn more about our own children. Thank you to all the participants, both with comments and questions. And just to let everyone know that you will, again, I want to remind you that you're going to be getting a survey in your email. Please fill those out. We really, really do use them. They're extremely helpful for our planning. We are our next, Betsy, could you forward to the, thank you.
I did.
our next session for parents will be on November 20th, Help Your Child Get Organized. I know lots of people who will really enjoy this one and will find it extremely helpful to bring some order to some of the chaos in their lives. Again, Rona and Betsy, thank you so much for what promises to be the first in a series of really wonderful, wonderful sessions. So thank you for making this as smooth as it was. And thank you to all the participants. If there are people who want to ask a question on the phone, they can click their hand raised icon. If people have more questions, again, they can post them into the chat room as well. That's also still a possibility. If people want to register for future webinars, please go to the Hidden Sparks website, to the webinar, click on the webinar Hidden Sparks at Walls area, which is on the right-hand side, and you'll be able to get all the information about future future webinars. Thank you.
I just
you,
want to
Rona
respond,
Betsy.
I just want to respond to Hedva also with one other thought. Families do recognize the special things in their children, but compare themselves to the children compare themselves to their peers. And one other resource that I want to suggest, just a wonderful resource, is books. Finding picture books about accepting difference and accepting who you are, it's a wonderful way to open up a dialogue with children. And there are, you know, children's librarians stand at the ready to help you find books on any topic, picture books, read aloud books, chapter books for any age that will help you open up wonderful dialogues with your children. So with that, I'm going to say good evening.